Don, if you could run that little video, that'd be great. Thanks.
Moms, on behalf of all the kids in the world, here are two things every mom needs to know. Number one, put down your phone, unless your kid is named Phone. Number two, don't name your kid Phone. That's just not right. That's messed up. Number three, we love you. It's just sometimes we don't know how to say it. Sometimes it just comes out screaming or crying. But the next time your kid screams, you know what they're really saying is, I love you, Mom. You're beautiful. Thank you for not naming me Phone. Four, stop cleaning. Our house isn't messy. Our house is awesome. It's awesome because we live in it. My mom got stuff to do. Number five, Mom upside down is wow. Doesn't really mean anything, but I just thought it was really cool. Wow. It should be like this. Wow, 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 wow. Number six. While I have you here, I want to take a second and talk about Meatloaf. Meatloaf's like a loaf of bread, but it's meat. Mom, we love you, but let's cool it on the Meatloaf. Number seven. Thank you for cleaning up all the poop. Number eight. Have fun for lunch. We love to see you have fun. Dance in the grocery store. I bought all this stuff. Or sing in the middle of a driveway. Oh, it'll feel great. And it'll scare your kids so much, they'll be quiet. Number nine. Hug more, shout less. Look, I get it. Sometimes we do something wrong. But growing up is scary. There's school, there's tests, there's telling times with clocks that have hands, there's tying your shoes, and kilograms and kilograms.
Kilograms?
I don't know, it's hard, but that's why I go to school. It's just hard to grow up. Sometimes we just need moms to tell us everything's okay. Number 10, the secret to changing the world, moms. Without moms, none of us will be here. Moms, kids love you. You, and you. If every mom in the world knew how awesome they were, every problem in the world would be fixed. From kids everywhere, thanks for believing in us, putting up with us, and straight up loving us. Mom, you keep us dancing. Who's been the awesome mom to you? Let them know you wouldn't be here without them. Keep present out.
I saw that the other day and I thought, oh, that's cute. Cute kid. He makes two things very clear. The first is that moms are incredibly important and we need to value them, appreciate them, more than we do, right? Take time and remember all of the ways that they bless us and encourage us. You say, well, my mom's gone. She's not around. And you thank the Lord for all the other ladies in your life and the way that they've encouraged you and blessed you and poured themselves into you. We need to understand and make room for that. Because you know that you get so busy with life that you forget more central, more important things. And the kid makes that clear. Need to bless them. Second thing that he makes clear is that moms aren't perfect, right? They're just people. They're just flawed people who struggle with making too much meatloaf on occasion, right? Now, I love meatloaf, and so I think we should have it more. Now, if we had it like every day, then maybe that'd be an issue. But just ordinary people who are dealing with challenges of life, and sometimes in the midst of our own stuff, we forget all the things that are going on or maybe going on that we don't know about in the hearts of our moms, of ladies that are around us, and we need to pray for them, encourage them, but to understand that that they're always dealing with issues, and that they too need to slow down, need to enjoy life, right? And to remind them to do that would be a good thing. You need to slow down and enjoy life a little bit more. I love what he says. Put down the phone unless your kid is named Phone, right? Don't name your kid Phone because that would be messed up. Stop cleaning. Cool it on the meatloaf. Have fun once in a while. Hug more. Shout less. I love that he encourages his mom and all moms. And then he gently challenges them to adjust maybe some of the things that they're doing and involved in so that they might enjoy life and the people around them more as well. It reminds me a lot of the way that Jesus interacted too with his mom. If you have your Bibles, we're going to look at John chapter 2 this morning, verses 1 to 11. It'll be in the Bibles. If you didn't bring one, you can be in the racks underneath the chairs on the screen as well behind me. John chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to his servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Well, the backdrop, what we have going on here is a wedding feast, Jewish wedding feast, a celebration that could last as long as a week. They really enjoyed and they celebrated that time when a husband and a wife would get together, and this was a part of their culture, and they enjoyed that. The financial responsibility for the wedding feast, for this week-long potential event, was the responsibility of the groom and his family. Those of you with girls go, "Why isn't it like that now?" Right? But it was the primary responsibility of the groom and his family, and so they would take care of all of these provisions. Now, in a culture where it's very shame-based and honor-based, to run out of wine would be a deeply shameful thing to have happen. How could you not have enough supplies? In our day, when you ran out of food or drink at a celebration like that, it's time to go home, right? It's like, it's done. Thanks for coming. Celebration's over. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. But thank you for coming, right? It's over. In looking a little bit more deeply into the story, we know that Mary has some degree of responsibility over the provisions. That's her concern about the lack of wine. She may have been related to the wedding party, to the groom, or she may have been asked to cater the event. There's no clear indications there, but regardless, she feels compelled to do something about the lack of wine. And it was wine with alcohol in it. I just wanted to have a little aside here. And we know that because down in verse 10, NIV doesn't do a good job of clarifying this, but when it says everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you have saved the best till now. The Greek word that's translated "had too much to drink" does not refer to consuming too much liquid. You guys are just drinking too much liquid. But to intoxication. So the wine definitely contains alcohol, but it's far less potent than what we have today. Back in Jesus' day, if they were to have a glass of wine that we have, they would consider that strong drink, and they'd look down on it. They would pour water in their wine, dilute it from anywhere from a third potency to a tenth of the potency. So it was quite diluted, and so they could drink lots of liquid. What I love about Mary's concern about the lack of wine is the way she expresses her concern. It seems to me that I've heard something like this before. She seems to be just stating a fact. Doesn't it just seem like a fact? See, men would look at that and go, that's just a fact, right? When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, they have no more wine. And a man would go, yeah, they're out of wine, right? But she's not just making a statement of fact. And every man knows that she's not making a statement of fact. She's making a request, actually a statement and a request together, right? It just reminded me of things like this. The garbage can is full. Yeah, sure is. It's full. The grass is getting long. Yeah, it is. Supper is getting cold. Okay. Different ways that men and women look at something like that. And all of those, when a woman states it, all of those require a response. They're not just a statement of fact. She's saying to Jesus, there's no more wine. And he understands it perfectly, what exactly she's saying. Mary isn't saying, there's no more wine, now everybody, you need to leave and go home. She's saying, there's no more wine. Jesus, you need to do something because the celebration is still going on, and this is going to negatively impact our family, especially the bride or the groom and his family. Here's what's interesting about the scenario. Everyone is influenced by cultural expectations. Everyone, all of us are. Family expectations and certain things that we do in our culture that are normative, and you go to a different culture and they have different things that are normative, right, that everybody does and everybody understands that. You have to be aware of what's going on in the culture. There's always cultural expectations that we have to be understanding. What's interesting is that Jesus doesn't feel the pressure that we feel when it comes to cultural expectations. If there's anything that affects Jesus, it's the cultural expectations of the kingdom, of God's kingdom. And that's why his first response in any and every situation is to try to discern, Father, what's your will in this? And how can I move to accomplish your will? He's always thinking about the characteristics, the cultural expectations of his Father in heaven. And that's his first response to all situations. His address to her isn't a natural or a normal response from a son. He calls her woman, not in a rude way, but definitely in a way that distances himself from his relationship to her, from her being his mother. He doesn't say, Mom. He calls her woman. And in fact, many, many translations of the Bible have tried to capture the meaning of the Greek. I just want to share a few of them with you. In the ESV, verse 4 is translated, and Jesus said to her, woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. In the New American Standard Bible, verse 4 is translated, and Jesus said to her, woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come. The J.B. Phillips version says, is that your concern or mine? Jesus replied, my time has not yet come. And in the Message, verse 4 reads, Jesus said, is that any of our business, mother, yours or mine? This isn't my time. Don't push me. Now, there are many different ways to interpret what he said to Mary, but all of them share a similar theme. Jesus is being respectful, but he's on the edge of what a mother might feel appropriate. If your son said to you, woman, now our culture's a little different, right? It's on the edge, though. He's being respectful, but it's on the edge of what mom would feel appropriate. And what we need to take away is that Jesus strategically creates distance from his biological relationship with his mother because his first and foremost responsibility is to discern and pursue the will of his Father in heaven. Mark 3:31-35 gives us even more clarity into that. It says this, then his mother and his brothers arrived, and standing outside, they sent word to him and called him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, behold, your mother and your brothers are outside looking for you. Answering them, he said, who are my brother? Who are my mother and my brothers? Looking about at those who were sitting around him, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, He is my brother and sister and mother. This is one of the most challenging things for any mother. But I imagine it would have been incredibly challenging for Mary. Every child has to grow up, and the process of growing up requires a degree of separation from family relationships, family influence. I'm not saying that there's a complete severing of family ties. You know that that's not healthy either. But there is a separating, a movement away from that kind of influence. And even when a mother wants God's very best for her son or daughter, sometimes it's incredibly painful when that separation begins to happen. And that young man or woman steps out on his own or on her own and starts making their own tracks on the journey that God has called them to walk. And what a mother does next, after that sense that there is a separation beginning between them and their children, is critically important. Mary doesn't harass Jesus. She doesn't micromanage his life. She simply says to those around him, do whatever he tells you to do. She expresses faith in Jesus' ability to do whatever he would feel would be the best thing to do. And there are some scholars who believe that Mary expected that Jesus would perform a miracle, that he would do something marvelous and solve the problem in a supernatural way. That she expressed so much faith that she knew that he would do something incredibly miraculous. There's even a second century story, an account of Jesus as a toddler turning clay pigeons into live birds. There's nothing biblical, no support biblically that he ever did that. But that would be an interesting thing as a kid, Jesus turning clay pigeons into living birds and letting them fly away. And very most, though, that we can say is that Mary had faith in Jesus to do what he thought what was best, and she left the results up to him. Ladies, can I encourage you to remember that faith beyond pain makes the impossible possible? Mary had to believe that Jesus would do what he felt was best, and that would be the best thing. And even though there was a separation there, and she could sense that, she knew that, there was something going on, but she said, do whatever he tells you to do. She leaves it up to him. And when, moms, you begin to feel that sense of tension beginning, where there's that separation, trust those people that you care about into the hands of the living God. And you will see that maybe some of the impossible things where you get worried and concerned because you can't imagine how this is going to work out in a good setting, or you're scared because you're not there to oversee and manage how you're doing, what's going on. This affects you at every level. When your kids go to the playground for the first time, when they stay over at a place, their friend's place, when they leave home, when they've been married for 10 or 15 years, you're still wondering, is everything okay? Are you okay? As men, we often don't understand why it's hard for you to let go or to release those that are closest to you and trust that God will do profound things in the lives of those that you love. God has wired you with a very strong desire to be relationally connected. But your primary connection is to be with him, is to be with Jesus, is to trust the Father. That doesn't mean that you feel things less when the people that you love and that you have great influence over begin to walk their own direction, and there's that disconnect that's beginning, separation. You don't feel that less. You don't love those people less. But it does mean that you express your faith, your deepest faith in God's ability to accomplish what he desires to accomplish in their lives. You release them to the Father. Let me say that this, if it's an ongoing thing, and it has to be an ongoing work where you continually, moment by moment, release your kids into the Lord's hands. Some of you, you've done that, and you know that there's a sense of relief as you trust God, but you know that it's not easy, and it never gets easy, and there's never a time where it's over, and you just go, it's all good now, right? But it's an ongoing work of your persistence in trusting Christ, expressing your faith. When Jesus says, my hour has not yet come, what does he mean? because he seems to be saying that this is the main reason why he would not rather not be involved, get involved in this situation. Some believe that Jesus' public ministry began with this miracle and that Jesus didn't believe that this was the time for that public ministry to start. Some believe that by referring to his hour, that it had not yet come. He was pointing ahead to the culmination of his ministry, to his death, his resurrection, his exaltation. And after his death, his burial, his resurrection, his exaltation, his followers would look back and they would understand in greater measure the meaning and importance of his hour, of his time, of the culmination of his ministry. And that he had called them into this ministry as well. Will you follow me? It means you need to pick up your cross and follow Jesus. You need to bear the challenges of life in the midst of a sinful world. And you need to express your devotion and your trust in God. And that someday your hour too would come. That you would have to give your life. And it doesn't have to be in the exact same way. But giving your life, dying to yourself, to your own desires and your dreams is a process, is a part of picking up our cross and following Christ. And we pursue Jesus, and we entrust those around us into the hands of Christ, and we pursue Jesus. We don't stop caring and loving, being concerned, but we stop having the kind of influence that we had on their lives when they were younger. Whatever Jesus had in mind in his remarks to Mary, there are several takeaways for us as we look at this miracle. Firstly, it had prophetic significance. Jesus understood that the prophets characterized the Messianic age as a time where wine would flow liberally. So this miracle would be a sign that God was beginning a new work, accomplishing his purposes for his people, and there would be this incredible revival, a celebration of life, newfound freedom and joy through the Messiah. Jeremiah 31:12 says, "They shall come and sing aloud on the height of Zion, and they shall be radiant over the goodness of the Lord, over the grain, the wine, and the oil, and over the young of the flock and herd. Their life shall be like a watered garden, and they shall languish no more." So there was this connection between the arrival of kingdom life and abundance of blessing. Let me just say that unless there is a connecting, an enjoining of kingdom principles and kingdom life and kingdom culture, you're not going to, actually it's the other way around, unless there's a separation of this physical life from the primary influence you have and connection with individuals within your family, unless you release that to the Lord, you can't have the deepest connection being your faith and trust in Christ. It will become a distorted, dysfunctional kind of relationship because God has called you into a relationship with him first and foremost and then with other people. His draw upon your life, his movement towards you, your movement towards him, his influence over you, your desire to be close to him has to be first and foremost primary. You need to make that the priority of your life. You need to spend time pursuing that. If you neglect that, then you won't have a whole lot to offer the people that God has called you to have influence over, even if it is for just a time, because it is just for a time. In Matthew 22:1-14, Jesus uses a parable of a wedding feast to describe the arrival of God's kingdom, when it will come in its fullness and there will be a heavenly celebration with all those that God has called to himself. Secondly, this miracle symbolized the transformation of established external customs of the day into something that represented the new life that God calls his people into. The stone jars. Now we might look at that and go, we just kind of gloss over that. Stone jars were for ceremonial cleansing. Hundreds of liters of water in a stone jar. It was the purification system, an outward religious act, external act. And it was the custom of the day to wash and to be clean. And Jesus, what he does is, he changes that. What was intended for an external act, washing of hands, it represents the old order of the Jewish law. And Jesus replaces it with something much better. And thirdly, Jesus never doubts what he has the power to do. We're told, then he told them, verse 8, "Now draw some water out and take it to the master of the banquet." You think, oh, okay. look, if you did that, if you performed the miracle, wouldn't you say, you know what, before you take it to the master of the banquet, could you just have me taste it? Make sure it's wine, right? Jesus never doubts what he has the power and ability to do. He says, do this, and then give it to the master of the banquet, because he never doubts what he can do. What would happen if we, as followers of Jesus, began to express our faith and trust in him in similar ways, that we trusted him to do what he could do, and we just left the results up to him? We sang a song about a burden. Wouldn't our burdens be less? Wouldn't we carry less concern, less worry, less fear, less resentment, less guilt? Wouldn't we? If we just trusted that Jesus himself has power and authority over all things to do exactly what he desires to do, and we entrust him with our lives, how would our lives look different? Might Jesus do even more than we can imagine him doing in or through us? If we want to see him do what only he can do, then we have to stop settling for what we think would be an appropriate response to the situation we find ourselves in. You bringing your wisdom or your strength to a situation has something of value, but it's not lasting, and it may not be the best thing for the situation. If we want to see kingdom realities that Jesus has in mind for us and the people we love, then we have to stop giving in to cultural or peer pressure that limits his activity, limits the possibility of what he can do. If we want to see him do what only he can do, then we have to start believing in Jesus, really believing, trusting him completely with our lives and the lives of our loved ones. Ken Davis tells a story of a time when he was in college. He was asked to prepare a lesson to teach his speech class. We were to be graded, he says, on our creativity and ability to drive home a point in a memorable way. The title of my talk was The Law of the Pendulum. I spent 20 minutes carefully teaching the physical principle that governs a swinging pendulum. The law of the pendulum is, a pendulum can never return to a point higher than the point from which it was released. Okay, that makes sense. Because of friction and gravity, when the pendulum returns, it will fall short of its original release point. Each time it swings, it makes less and less of an arc, until finally it's at rest. This point of rest is called the state of equilibrium, where all forces acting on the pendulum are equal. I attached a 3-foot string to a child's toy top and secured it to the top of the blackboard with a thumbtack. I pulled the top to one side and made a mark on the blackboard where I let it go. Each time it swung back, I made a new mark. It took less than a minute for the top to complete its swinging and come to a rest. When I finished the demonstration, the markings on the blackboard proved my thesis. I then asked how many people in the room believed the law of the pendulum was true. All of my classmates raised their hands. So did the teacher. He started to walk to the front of the room, thinking the class was over. In reality, it had just begun. Hanging from the steel ceiling beams in the middle of the room was a large, crude, but functional pendulum, 250 pounds of metal weights, tied to 4 strands of 500-pound test parachute cord. I invited the instructor to climb up on a table and sit in a chair with the back of his head against a cement wall. Then I brought the 250 pounds of metal up to his nose, holding the huge pendulum just a fraction of an inch from his face. I once again explained the law of the pendulum he had applauded only moments before. If the law of the pendulum is true, then when I release this mass of metal, it will swing across the room and return short of the release point. Your nose will not be in danger. After that restatement of this law, I looked him in the eye and asked, "Sir, do you believe this law is true?" There was a long pause. Huge beads of sweat formed on his upper lip, and then he weakly nodded and whispered, "Yes." I released the pendulum. It made a swishing sound as it arced across the room. At the far end of its swing, it paused momentarily and started back. I never saw a man move so fast in my life. He literally dove from the table, deftly stepping around the still swinging pendulum. I asked the class, "Does he believe in the law of the pendulum?" The students unanimously answered, No! When you feel as though you're backed into a corner with nowhere to go, there's nothing you can do, will you believe Jesus for your life? Will you entrust yourself into his hands? Will you entrust those you love into his hands? Do you believe that Jesus loves the people that you love even more than you love them? Do you believe that? Really believe that? When you leave, you can begin to practice that. Do you believe it? Or is it only truth that you know in your head? Let me encourage you. Allow it to sink and settle and permeate your heart so that you trust more and more. Your faith is expressed in greater measure. And you see the glory of Jesus, his ability to accomplish incredible things, making the impossible possible. And you go, that's amazing that that happened. It's not amazing when Jesus, you allow him to do what he does, what he knows is best. And trust those that you love into his care. Would you do that? Worship team, come on up. And we will wrap up our worship this morning.